Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown. And today I have a wonderful guest, John DeLeo. Hi, John.
Hi, Grace. How you doing?
I'm doing good. John has been on the show, and he knows his movies. He's written some great books. He's written 10 movies at a time. He's written great performances that you should know but probably don't. You have a Tennessee Williams. What's that called?
Tennessee Williams and Company.
And you have your quiz book.
And Screensavers 1 and 2.
You guys can all find them. I'm going to link them all up, and you'll be able to find them. But today, John and I are going to do, I think it's kind of a fun podcast. We're doing an anti-Valentine's podcast. We're doing one that pictures you would watch, movies you'd watch, and say, you know, don't feel sorry for yourself. You're not alone. You could be this. So, you know, because that's how I feel. You know, it's a day and it's made to make people feel bad if they don't have someone in their life. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. There's so many movies that fit. We were having fun narrowing it down. Shall I start the show?
Start with your first one, and I love this choice, you guys. It's wonderful. Go ahead.
Well, Bride of Frankenstein from 1935 is a good one because, you know, essentially at its core, it's a movie about loneliness, about the monster trying so hard to connect with friends and, of course, eventually wanting a mate. And I guess the tragedy of Bride of Frankenstein is that, you know, Dr. Frankenstein literally makes someone for the one and only purpose of being that mate, and she hates you on sight, and the whole relationship lasts 4 minutes,
ending with
going up the tower, and so it really couldn't have gone any worse, and it's so, you know, that's the greatness of Boris Karloff. He's so available to love and be loved.
It's
so crushed.
Oh my God.
And we are too.
Definitely. And I always thought that it wouldn't be the same movie, but don't introduce him to the bride yet. You know, give her some mirrors, let her catch a look at herself, scream a little bit, and then maybe Frankenstein would start looking, you know, the monster would start looking a little better to her. He broke my heart. I mean, that performance by Boris Karloff, people think, oh, he just was a monster. He just echoed every heartache and heartbreak that he had. And he knew he wasn't supposed to be alive. Like I always said, the monster in the movie is Dr. Frankenstein, because he's playing and doing all this stuff. And the poor monster is lonesome and just wants to be loved. So I guess, it just makes us all feel so sad for him.
Yeah. And I think it was one of the astonishing things about Karloff is the fact that he is wearing so much makeup and the amount of emotion, both physically in terms of his body language and the expressions on his face within all that makeup. It's remarkable how much comes through all of that and is so moving. But you're right, the whole idea of this relationship being so rushed, I mean, they're thrust upon each other immediately. And like I said, the whole sequence, it's hard to believe, but the whole thing happens in 4 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, couldn't they let her do her hair? You know, they could have fixed him up a little. It was ridiculous. It's like, wham, bam, here's your bride. You know, a girl needs some time. You don't just push her dreamboat into her face. I think, you know, I have my theories, and it just broke my heart. And I think
A teeny bit of a crush on Dr. Frankenstein, it always looks like, you know, that she meets him first and he's sort of her god, having created her. And she's, you know, she goes, remember, she kind of lunges back toward Dr. Frankenstein to protect her from the monster, not really understanding what the whole setup was because she has nothing to do with it, of course.
She has no idea she's not a dish, you know, but Frankenstein thinks she's a dish. What is more beautiful than that? This guy doesn't care how she looks. And here she is, looks-ix. You know, it's a little shallow, Bride of Frankenstein.
And it's not just rejection, but actually kissing. You know, some very unkind things happen.
Great choice. So you guys, just remember, if women or men, if you're a monster and you meet your monster mate and they don't like you, you're better off knowing. You know, if she's going to scream the minute she sees you, she's out of there. Next, next, next. Right?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know if that's a lesson we could all apply, but I think the other choices are a little more universal than that one.
Right. It is. And it's so very sad. So I'm going to use one. And this is a film starring Bette Davis, Herbert Marshall, and basically, Gail Sondergaard. And I don't really know the other actors very well, but this movie shows you how you can be so in love with your wife and have not one clue of who this woman is. She is, It opens with Betty, and she's living in, I guess he's a rubber plant guy from England. They come over and they stay there. And then they have these people who, you know, come there and they have their little community. So Betty, it opens with her and her outfit and her shoes and then shooting this person we never see. And not only does she shoots him until that last bullet is gone and tries to shoot him some more, but there are no more bullets. And she makes up this huge story to Herbert Marshall, how brave she is. She goes on and on how he tried to attack her and tell her. First, he said, if you didn't wear glasses, you have such pretty eyes. The fiend. It was all this thing that they're all, poor Leslie. And come to find out, she meant to shoot the dude, and she had been cheating on her husband all this time, and she got furious that the boyfriend wouldn't see her anymore because he married an Asian woman played by Gail Sondergaard. And it's all about her lying, her lawyer feeling so conflicted about taking the case, and he wasn't doing it for her. He was doing it for Herbert Marshall. And you just see, you know, there she is, Miss Priss, and she's in her glasses, and she crochets those little delicate things. And then in the meantime, she's like a tigress, rawr, for this other guy, you know?
Yeah.
What's your
thoughts? One of the chilling things about the Bette Davis character in the letter is that, you know, she's under the veil of respectability. Mm-hmm. You know, everything about her is this great lady. They've got this sort of, transplanted British society that they've set up in Southeast Asia, pretending they're still, you know, in London. And she is so respectable. Herbert Marshall's, he's so dignified, the wife, and that she is so duplicitous. And then expects not only to have this affair going on the side, but then to murder the guy and then expect to be able to get away with it. And so there are so many unattractive qualities about her. And you're right, her husband's, you know, being completely in the dark about who she really is.
Yeah, he thinks she's just the dutiful, wonderful wife. He's taking her word for everything she says. So does the other guy. And so does the lawyer they get, who is best friends. I mean, his wife is best friends with Betty, and his lawyer is best friends with Herbert. And never in a million years, they're all on Betty's side, and they can't really grasp, you know, how this demure little flower, you know, she had to have had to protect herself. But it's really interesting, and it just shows you, when you're married to somebody, don't think you know everything. You don't. You know, maybe she's not having an affair and murdering people. Maybe he's not having an affair and murdering people. But there are always secrets. And not as dramatic as this one, but it really shows you that, you know, you can think you're just living large and then you find out, because there was a letter, that's the meaning of the word, the letter, and she tries to deny it. It was the wife of the man she murdered had the letter, and it was her asking the guy to come see her. She won't answer the consequences if he won't come. And then first she denies to the lawyer, and she said, it's not my handwriting. And he said, I know. And then he said, tell me the truth. And she kind of faints and asks, are you going to let them hang me? And I think he would have wanted her to be hanged, because he was so conflicted, because he had to get 10 grand for the letter. And where do they get it from? Poor sucker, Mr. Marshall, who seems to get really suckered in a lot of films, I hate to say. You know, he doesn't always come out right.
And of course, the next year, the same team, Betty and Herbert Marshall and William Wyler again on The Little Foxes, and she's an equally bad wife to him in that one.
She is a barracuda.
For financial reasons, but she is, essentially responsible for his death, which could be, it's a sort of a version of a murder.
Right.
And
cold-blooded.
So that was quite, they had quite a chemistry of a bad marriage.
Yes, and he found out. It was so sad, because he wanted her to get out of there, to make it better, to start fresh. And at first she was, gung-ho about it. And then he said, the 10,000 he saved, they can get this huge place and move away and start over. And then she's like, humana. And she knows that there's no money there. And then the lawyer said, well, we had to pay money. And then Herbert gets to read the letter, and he's devastated, absolutely devastated, that his Leslie was such a liar. And Leslie, he was going to forgive her. But the famous line, I can't. I'm still in love with the man I killed. I love that. Poor Herbert. But it just shows you that, you may be envying people right next door to you, right? And going, oh, what a wonderful life they have. Look at them. They look so perfectly in love. And they could be doing really rotten things, and they're nothing like you thought. So be grateful that you're not married, for one reason, because you could hook up with Leslie or Betty Davis, or nothing's perfect. So with all this illusion about Valentine's Day, get the $20 cards, get the flowers that are $2,000 on Valentine's Day, and get the chocolates, does not make romance. So that's basically my thing about this. I love romantic movies, don't get me wrong. I just don't like Valentine's Day. Okay, so John, your turn.
I thought another interesting one is Leave Her to Heaven from 1945 with Gene Tierney. Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting movie about obsessive love, because you wouldn't call what Gene Tierney feels for anybody in this movie a love you'd want to be around.
No.
But to her, it is so all-consuming, it borders on – it's a kind of craziness. It's a kind of insanity. And yes, the movie hints at a twisted relationship that she had with her father, who's dead when the movie starts, and that she sort of projects whatever – that was onto Cornell Wilde. And then once he becomes the object of her obsessive love and she wins him over and they get married and all, she cannot tolerate any kind of competition, but not in the ways you'd expect, like the threat of another woman becoming attractive to him. It's in jealous of his work as a writer, jealous of his relationship with his kid brother, jealous of his friendship with her own cousin, played by Jean Crane, and then ultimately jealous of her unborn child.
And she's also jealous of her mother as well.
Yeah, and this takes on proportions that will make the movie kind of fascinating and sort of so juicy as a melodrama. You can't believe what's coming and what's going to go next and how they top with what you just saw. But it is a kind of absolutely fascinating. And like you said, it starts in a kind of normal way of two very attractive people meeting on a train and sort of being hot for each other and it leading to marriage. But, and of course, again, the obliviousness of the Cornell Wilde character, not all the way through, but for longer than you can believe, the things she is up to that he is not onto for a good deal of the picture, which of course makes it so juicy.
Yeah, he's not the brightest guy in this movie, that's for sure. And the thing that makes it so amazing is that Jean Tierney is so incredibly beautiful. And you can't expect this beauty to be so, she has a sickness. I really believe she has a sickness. And the other thing that makes me go, ew, is always saying how much Richard looks like her father.
Yeah.
And that's like gross. You know, I would never want to go out with anyone that looked like my father, please.
And that's a kind of thing that rarely comes up in old movies. I mean, that's really kind of hinting at things they could never really deal with that they would today. So it is kind of an interesting other element to it. The other amazing thing about Leave Her to Heaven is the fact that it's in Technicolor.
Gorgeous.
And you know, when you describe the plot, you're picturing, you know, a Mildred Pierce-looking movie or a Double Indemnity, something fabulous, stylish, black and white with all these terrible things going on, but it looks no different than a Betty Grable musical, which is fascinating stylistically because the content and the style are consistently at odds, but they enforce each other in very unusual ways. And I think that's why the movie is so fascinating to people, because there are very few movies with that kind of plot, with those kinds of characters that look like this kind of movie. And so, like I said, the style content clash brings up some really just fascinating things all the way through.
Yeah, it's great. And of course, Vincent Price was there and she dumps Vincent Price saying she's marrying Richard, but he didn't even know. Cornell Wilde didn't even know he was getting married to her. She announces it in front of everyone and they had not even talked about it. So he just goes, oh, okay, we'll get married. And she is duplicitous in the point where she goes to Warm Springs to help Danny. Danny had polio or something like that,
yes.
And his legs were getting better, and Alan is helping him being they spent their honeymoon there, and Alan is helping him and being, you know, like Miss Wonderful, and we'll surprise Dick, don't tell him. Until the doctor says, I think the best thing for Danny is to go back to, it's back of the moon, right? That beautiful lake. And she said, it's all on me. And after all, he's a cripple. And the doctor sees right through her. He sees that she's just, you know, she's not what she seems to be. And then, you know, when Richard comes in, Richard, I wanted to be the first person to tell you Danny can come home. So she's really something else. And she's pretty smart. She plans it out and Vincent Price comes back. And I have to say the court scene was over the top. And the guy in the beginning says, I may have lost the case for him, his friend, the lawyer. I'm like, you may have. Vincent Price is going on and on, screaming and screaming with no objections from the defense. And it's just amazing. And it's a great movie. It's beautiful. And it's beautiful to see, and it's fascinating to see such a beautiful woman, so insecure and willing to do anything to keep that man all to herself. And like you said, kill her unborn child, saying that she slipped going down. She looked gorgeous, didn't she, when she went down those stairs?
Yeah.
Her tone.
And I have to say, since it is such a dark story, it does end with a very romantic scene that is so beautiful.
It is.
I give it away, but After all the drama is essentially over, it doesn't leave you with a bad feeling. It's a beautiful ending.
It is.
But again, visually, it just does not quit. And in the big scene on the lake, it's the sort of peak of the awful doings, and yet it's so colorful and gorgeous, you almost expect Esther Williams to swim right by.
You do. You know. You do. And another thing I wanted to say about the film was that she was so pretty. And people, okay, this is what I meant to say to you guys. I'm like giving advice to anybody. It's like I'm Dear Gracie here. But obsession is not love. So if you think you're in with somebody, oh, he gets jealous if I do this, or she gets jealous if I do that, they look at my text messages, they check this and that. Oh, it's not because they love you so much. It's because they want to own you and they are so jealous. So beware of these possessive kind of relationships. That doesn't mean they really love you like you think they do. What do you think about that,
Dan? She wants to control every aspect of everything. You know, that's part of her sickness. She doesn't really want him to just be himself. She wants him to be exactly what she wants him to be at all times. Yes. So, yeah, that's not quite love.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people out there who think, oh, my God, he's so crazy about me. Look the way he loves me, blah, blah, blah. Talk is cheap, too. You know, when someone tells you they love you, you know, they can be saying it because they mean it, or they can be saying it because they think that's what you want to hear and they can get what they want. So this movie is just like, beware of gorgeous chicks on trains. And do not ever go out with someone who says either one, you look just like my father, or you look just like my mother. Run for the hills. Run as fast as you can. Right? Can you imagine? And my father wasn't a bad looking man, but yuck. You know, gee whiz. Ew. Okay, so my turn is next. And this one might surprise you guys. Did it surprise you, John?
Which one?
Now Voyager.
No, I think it's a good one to bring up because, again, it's got an interesting conflict that isn't necessarily the norm for the Golden Age.
Right. And it's not really a happy ending. And as we know, I love this film, but there are parts of it I just don't love. And it stars Betty, and she has this, she lives in Boston with her controlling mother, the fabulous, Gladys Cooper, who is wonderful. And Betty is this frumpy dump. You know, they make her try to look like she has a stomach. She has like a unibrow. Her hair is so spinsterish, and she's wearing like spinster shoes and spinster clothes picked out by her mother. And she's been so beaten up by her mother that she just goes inside herself. And she's basically having a nervous breakdown. And she has her room upstairs. That's her only respite from her mother. And she has, like, cigarettes and things like that. And her sister-in-law wants her to get help and brings in one of my favorite actors, Mr. Claude Rains. And he plays a psychiatrist that, you know, kind of takes the mother to task and says she's having a nervous breakdown. And she goes away, and we don't see her. And her sister-in-law comes to pick her up, and they can't get over the change of her, that she's lost these pounds, and they get her glam plus. And then they put her on a boat and pretend she's this, I don't know what, a comic or something? Camille Beauchamp. And
society lady.
Yes. So they have all these beautiful clothes for her, and they, you know, put little notes on it, which way she's supposed to wear it, what she's supposed to do. And she is just, you know, shy. And in the midst of it, she meets Mr. Paul Henreid, known as Jerry. And he treats, you know, she's actually very attractive and he treats her nice. She's like a starved dog waiting for that bone. You know what I mean? I don't mean it. She has never, she's hungry for any kind of attention and any kind of love that she can get. And she gets it from Jerry, who's married and has two children. And they become, I guess, they had that one night. They'll always have that one night. When the car crashed, I guess. And and he's like Mr. Romantic. And he called her, "You're the only person that's ever called me darling." And, you know, she's just, and he gets her a bottle of perfume for helping her with his kids. And she's just like in heaven here. But the dude's married with kids. And he keeps saying, "I can't leave my wife, Isabel. She's sick. She's sick." And so Betty knows a score on that. And they leave, and they do that cigarette smoking thing and separate, which is a riot. And she goes back to Boston and shows her mother, struts her stuff in front of her mother, who is not pleased with the change in her daughter, to say the least. Right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. She starts bossing her around again. When Charlotte gets home, she sees that her mother has had a nurse, but she's canning the nurse so that Betty can go back to her daughterly duties. And not only did she can the nurse, while Betty was gone, she brought all the things from her bedroom upstairs into the room next to her that used to be her father's room and went spying through old Betty's stuff. "Oh, those books, you should be ashamed." And, you know, just horrible, just really mean. And she's going to become meek again, except she gets this flower in the mail with no name. And it's a chameleon, whatever. What are they called? Chameleons. And it's, she knows it's from Jerry, and she gets the strength, and she dolls up, and she really changes. And, you know, she still loves Jerry. And at one of the parties, her rotten niece all of a sudden becomes nice, Bonita Granville, who was wonderful at bratty people. And Betty throws a party, and she wants to light the fire. It's never been lit. They're all like, her brothers are all older than her. And she just feels, you know, liberated. Jerry's confidence in her and Jerry's bit of darlings and "I love you, I'm Camille" kind of thing. And she feels emboldened. And then her mother has to accept stuff and she goes back up into her room, whatever. And she gets engaged to this staid Boston dude, Elliot, who has two sons, and he wants her to marry him. What do you think of him?
Well, I think what the movie sets up with that character played by John Loder is that she has an option. She can assume the life she was meant to have, the one that her mother sort of would picture her having, becoming a Boston matron with a lot of money and taking her place in society. But Betty Davis doesn't love this guy, and I think with the movie, in terms of the romantic element, what it's about is compromise, in that she can have all that, but what she really, really wants more than anything is to love and be loved. And the way she can have that is imperfect, because he is married, unhappily, and we know the woman's not a good mother either from her treatment of the daughter, who's Tina, like Charlotte.
Right.
And so we don't have that much sympathy for this woman we don't see. So Charlotte makes the choice of the imperfect love because the famous line, "Don't let's ask for the moon, we have the stars." We can't have it all, but what we've got, however compromised, is better than anything else I see out there for me, because this is real and that would have been just a show. And so that's her victory, you know, as compromised as it is.
Yeah, and also we've skipped out on Dr. Jack with Claude Rains, was wonderful in this. He was her friend. He was everything. And then after she says, it's so funny that part where she said, "Perhaps if we could go somewhere bohemian, I knew a story about a woman who had a few drinks that she doesn't usually have, and she lost her inhibitions. And this, that, and then he's thinking, you tramp, you trollop, this is you. And he says, maybe we're both thinking the same things. Maybe I can take our honeymoon tickets and take my two sons, because he's such a priss bomb. And that romance is over. She tells the mother yells at her and then has a heart attack. And Betty feels that it's her fault, and she thinks she's going to have a nervous breakdown again. And she goes back to that place, Cascade, and she sees Tina immediately. Tina's like this greasy-haired girl with glasses and not very attractive, no self-esteem, and Betty takes it upon herself to take care of Tina and asks her to come to Boston and lives with her, and she does. She loves Betty. But I, in this whole thing, I don't like Paul Henreid in this. I just find him, you know, she was just so hungry for any kind of love. Now she gets the love of Tina. And this guy, you know, showing up here, there, and everywhere, she could have found somebody that was more suited for her if she had more time, if she had the inclination, but she decided to just devote her life to his child, our child. And I thought it was sad. It's sort of like beware guys on cruises, you know, because, you know, maybe the person loves you, but if they're married, yikes. And do you want to raise their kid and not have him? But she thought it's complicated, but I just, you know, the whole Jerry character got on my nerves. And as Betty Davis said, she wanted her character to marry Claude Rains because they had that stuff in common. He was spunky and Jerry was basically weak, very weak.
Well, you know, it's also, there's that thing of in the golden age with these strong women, these great actresses and their vehicles, how often the male character is just someone to be there. You
know? And to light her cigarette.
It's Marshall, or it's George Brent, or it's Paul Henreid. Not that they're bad actors. They're not.
Not at all.
But they're not of equal value. And so I always feel like sometimes the way we look at some of those characters, they are sort of hazy. They're not as fully drawn because they're not really meant to be more than that. It's so completely the woman's story that it's hard for them to feel three-dimensional often. And I think he's a pretty good example. He's a rather vague figure. And all the women in that movie are more dominant as personalities and more complicated. And he's just someone we have to sort of accept as she loves him. Okay, he's the one, and I'll go with it because she makes you believe it. But you're right. There are certainly – was more open to her, and it was sort of like falling for the first guy who said hello.
And said, I love you, and called her darling. Yeah.
And I think his appeal, again, really nothing against Paul Henreid, but that kind of figure, I don't think it's as attractive as it may have been in 1942. I don't really see Paul Henreid particularly as a romantic figure.
Me either.
I see him more, he is in Casablanca, as someone you're with, but it's because, you know, you thought you were never going to see the other guy again.
Yeah, he doesn't make your heart go pitter-patter, but I know some people really love Paul Henreid, so we're not really dissing him. I just that he, you know, he was not, you know, the great leading man, although, you know, I did love the one... What's it? The Deception with Claude Rains, who is amazingly strong again, and she has to hide everything because she thinks that Paul Henreid again is such a weak man that he can't take half of this stuff.
Oh, right.
So
right.
Yeah, Betty took him on. She did. Okay, your turn.
Oh, Well, continuing with Claude Rains, Notorious in 1946, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, of course, starring Ingrid Bergman and Cary Grant. This one is one of the more complicated love stories, or rather love triangles. It's got so much that's so interesting for the 1940s, stuff that you would imagine would have been explored many decades later, but is hints at them or goes beyond hinting to really make it complex. So you've got Ingrid Bergman, who's sort of shattered by her father's Nazi past. She's become a wild kind of playgirl. And Cary Grant, working for the U.S. government, is part of the team that hires her as a spy, so she can infiltrate Nazi Claude Rains and marry him and get the goods on him. So, but of course, Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman fall in love. And the interesting thing about the Cary Grant character is he loves her, but he also feels a kind of contempt for her at her, not just her past, but her ability to do the thing he hired her to do, which is to marry someone else and to sleep with him and to be his wife in all ways. And so you're doing a good job for the team, but I think of you as some kind of tramp, and right. I demean you and I make you feel bad about it, even though I love you. And then you've got Claude Rains on the other side of this, oblivious, who's in love with a woman very deeply who has no feeling for him and is using him completely for this mission that he knows nothing about. So she's in the middle of this thing, pulled on both ends, and yet an entirely sympathetic character.
She right? is. You feel sorry for her. Cary is so mean to her. I mean, it's up to you. You didn't have to choose to do this. But she asked him, do you want me to do this or not? And he said, "It's not. You know, you do what you want to do. It's not up to me." And she didn't want to do that. I mean, I can't even imagine marrying someone, you know, and he wants the Nazi thing go. And he's so madly in love with her. And he, you know, he's just possessive as well. And he's jealous of Devlin because he's so handsome. And he makes note of that quite a few times. And then there's his mama, who never liked Ingrid, but I don't think she'd like any woman because she loved her son so much. They had such a close relationship. And she was, boy, wasn't she? She was great. She was so creepy. And they all were. And I just can't imagine having to have a sexual relationship to get stuff. It's like Mata Hari kind of stuff. And yeah. And you do feel sorry for her because she felt pressured into doing it. She really did, because he didn't ask her not to.
And she does, on one level, she does want to do something good for the anti-Nazi movement to sort of make up for what her father did. But of course, who would have imagined this situation? And again, she's only doing it because of Cary Grant, and then, of course, to be resented by him for doing it, even though we know he loves her too, he just has very mixed feelings about the whole thing. And she is, like I said, in the middle of this impossible situation. It does sort itself out, and we hope, you know, Cary Grant has has come to terms.
And grown up a little bit and known that he's the one who asked her and gives her respect, but he's another one. You know, you have to watch out for these guys that are horrible. You know, he can't express his feelings, you know, so he's this guy and is sending you off into the land of a Nazi home with tons of Nazis around. And you know what? As Hitchcock said, the MacGuffin, I mean, that was like the stupidest thing ever. She steals the key and she has no, you know, if he's looking for it during the night and then it's back on the thing, it's so ridiculous. Like, how is he not going to find them? And he does. And she apologizes.
It's probably the best use of the dark side of Cary Grant. You know, the casting is so good, and he really goes there, as we would say. You know, he doesn't shy away from that sort of dark, distant quality in Cary Grant. You know, it's in Suspicion as well, but this is better written. So
it makes it more complicated.
I think, except in terms of just content, for a 40s movie, this thing tackles all kinds of things that are really different. And they do it well enough that even though they can't always be explicit about things, it kind of is because of the way it's acted and the subtext and in the lines. And so that's why it's one of Hitchcock's greatest movies. And it's kind of a high point for everybody involved.
Yeah, I think it's my favorite Hitchcock movie. I really love this movie. And Carrie is so dark. So what we would say in Notorious is just be glad no one's asking you to become a Nazi's wife or husband. What else do we get out of this? That, you know, someone can love you and be so rotten and mean, and all you want is a kind word from him every once and again, and he just is too jealous and ambivalent and whatever. That, you know, it's a sad relationship, and I my heart goes out to Ingrid in this movie.
Sure,
because she was just doing what she thought she was supposed to be doing, and he didn't say don't do it, so he just resented her all the way. Okay, now we're going to talk about one that you guys I'm sure know, and boy oh boy, Gaslight. And that is great. It's a term still today. And it starred Ingrid Bergman and Charles Boyer. And as a little tardy, was that her first role?
Yeah.
Angela Lansbury. She was very good. And as Nancy. And then there was the other one who couldn't hear. So Paula, Ingrid Bergman, was a little child, and her aunt was a great stage actress and singer, and Paula actually found her dead in the house in England. And then she went away, and we find her again, and she's singing for some maestro dude. And I don't think he's liking, you know, she's not really meant to be a singer. And they agree to that, and they end it. And then outside, she runs into the man who happens to be a pianist, and he asks her to marry her. I love you, Paula, and all that stuff. And she says she's going to take a break to see, you know, they don't even know each other. But then he's waiting for her at the station where she gets off. And she's young. She's never had a relationship before. And she marries him. And he plays the good guy. He plays like, you know, he's Mr. Sweet Stuff. And until he marries her. And then, oh, my dream is to live in England in one of those beautiful squares. And they get the house. And once they move there, poor Ingrid, just doesn't happen. He starts gaslighting right away. Doesn't wait a moment. And he is cruel and awful and makes Ingrid think she's losing her mind. And he also is looking for these jewels. And the thing is, he loved these jewels, but he knew he could never sell them. They were so famous. It was just he loved the jewels. Isn't that weird? Just loving jewels to look at jewels, murdering people to look at jewels. I don't get it.
Yeah, he is he's not well.
No, he's obviously awful. And Nancy has a little crush flirtation on him. And there's Joseph Cotten, who wants to rescue her because he sees that she, you know, she is publicly humiliated. And he's trying to make everyone around see that she's crazy. And when he finally gets rid of her, he wants to go to a mental institution. He tells her mother was found in a mental institution. She had no mind left, and that was going to happen to her. But Joseph Cotten was on the lookout for her, and as Dame May Whitty was too, who's always fabulous, right?
Oh, I love Dame May Whitty, and I guess the Joseph Cotten role is there primarily so that at the end we can believe there's some romantic possibility left to Ingrid. We can imagine that that friendship will turn bloom into love, and that she'll be happy.
Which is, to me, ridiculous, because she is just being, tortured, and she doesn't know what's what. And then she finally finds out who this man is. And I love the scene in the attic when he's tied up and he said, "Paula, let me go," whatever. And she pretends. And then she said, "Oh, where is the knife? Where is this? And she just says, "Take him away." But the thing with Joseph Cotten after that, I guess the theme for this one is, if you get involved with a monster like Charles Boyer in this movie, who's trying to hurt you and gaslight you and put you in a mental institution, my advice is give it a rest. Take some time for yourself. Hook up with Joseph Cotten later on down the line and just recover from the trauma you've been through, right? Like right after all this, she's supposed to be, "Oh, Joseph Cotten, I love you." And she's just been tortured. She's been through the worst. And he can be her friend, but, I just, as a love interest, it's supposed to make us feel happy, I guess, because people want that good ending, that there is a love interest. And I'm sure after a while, he would be wonderful. But Ingrid really needed to chill a little bit, take some time out for herself.
Yeah, that's just like, say, in the interest of a quick wrap up to sort of tie it up as quickly as you can. But you're right, in the normal course of events, it would take considerably more time. But you want to send everybody out reassured.
Yes, that she's okay and she's in good hands with Joseph Cotten, whom I love too. I love your last choice.
The Heiress, which interestingly is sort of in the same world as Gaslight. It's not a murderous melodrama, but it's again about fortune hunters and how easily it is to be their prey if you're whatever, needy and
starving
lonely
for love and never had that.
That's exactly. And so, of course, the consequences are more heightened in Gaslight and more realistic in The Heiress, where there aren't quite those dirty doings, and yet it's more the emotional cruelty and the fact that, yes, you have to at some point acknowledge that this person that you have fallen madly in love with may in fact have no interest in you beyond your money. And of course, Olivia de Havilland, try though she might, ultimately must face that, even though it means that her father, her cruel father, was absolutely right from the beginning. And he's been so awful to her that we don't want that to be true, but he pegs Montgomery Clift. And, one of the saddest things about The Heiress is this kind, very sweet young woman is forced to become cynical and so deeply hurt that she is forever changed by the way people have treated her, both in her family and by this young man who sort of sweeps her off her feet, and she'll never be the same.
Yes. And the thing, one thing I thought Olivia was fabulous. I liked Montgomery, although he didn't like his performance in it. I liked Olivia, but when she went from having that sweet little meek voice to becoming this lady who talks like this, I thought that was extreme. I thought it could have been a little, kind of that she didn't sound like some bitter 90-year-old within an hour after all this stuff has happened.
No, it's later because they I don't remember how many, is it years later when, after he's jilted her and doesn't show up that night, and then he hears that she's back and the father has since died and she has in fact inherited all the money after all. Because that's when he leaves, when she lets it slip that if she runs off with him, her father has threatened to cut her off. That's all he has to hear. And of course, he's gone.
Yes.
And then however long it takes, if it's months or if it's years later, that Ralph Richardson is in fact dead.
Ralph Richardson died very soon after. Remember? She said she didn't want to see him. He was asking for her when she died. And years had passed, and she was still in the square, and she would never leave it. And her aunt, who meant well, played by Miriam Hopkins, tells Olivia that she saw this guy. Guess who I saw? And all of a sudden, knock, knock, knock. And she invites him there. And Olivia takes him in, and then she listens to his lies again and says he only left because he didn't want her to be disinherited. And, you know, the ending was really, I think, what it should have been.
Yeah, and I think, one of the things about the ending that stings is that we've seen how cruel her father has been through most of the movie, and that, not that it isn't justified in her case in terms of her treatment of Montgomery Clift, but that she too has a capacity for a cruelty, and it's almost like she never wanted to have to find that out, but the circumstances of her life and the treatment she's received shows that she too, when pushed, has that same capacity that's sort of in the genes. And it stings. Like I said, it stings, and the movie stays with you.
It does. And it's a really good movie. And I think the scene with the sister and the father, I loved that scene. I thought that was wonderful. You know, and she, you know, she's really shy. Maybe Morris has, you know, changed what he thinks is attractive. And, you know, he wears the best stuff. And that, he just, like, seems so in love with Olivia. And she's just like, you know, she's as plain as can be. And, you know, he just didn't love her. He loved the fact of the mula ula bula. When the father said, let's go to Europe, the aunt had Montgomery to the house every night. He was drinking his port, drinking his cigars, and he's the father stuff, just making himself at home, where he was like, I'm going to be here, yeah, because he thought that Olivia could convince him. But that didn't happen, and Monty, we don't know what happened to him. And we know Olivia remained embittered, and I don't think she ever married. That's my take.
It doesn't feel like, yeah, you're right. It doesn't feel like that's what she's headed to, sort of play the field. It looks like it's like she's done. She'll never let anyone hurt her again. But so, you know, this one hits on a lot of the points we've been talking about in terms of the vulnerability of people, is that even when there are sort of warning signals, so we want to believe the person really loves us for us. We want to believe this is the person. There's so many things that make people, particularly in movies and in real life, make mistakes, do the wrong thing because of a genuine feeling of wanting this to be that special something.
And being so insecure and having that, like just having someone seem so, you know, pretending he adored her and thought whatever. And she just ate it up. You know, she was starving, and he just took away her man meat, and she was going to starve for the rest of her life about men. That's how I feel. And we have one more, and I'm choosing in name only because of the wonderful, horrible Kay Francis in this movie. She is wonderful in this. She makes the movie. I really believe she does. This is a movie starring Cary Grant. This is one of the movies that Carol Lombard wanted to make because she wanted to move more into a drama, some dramatic roles. So she took the part, and Kay and Cary Grant, and in name only is basically the thing. He is lonesome. He doesn't go to the parties. And the family, this gets me, his family sides with her all the time. And he meets Julie, cute, who is Carol Lombard, and they fall in love within, I think, 12 minutes. And he wants to marry her after about 8 days. I mean, it's all very rushed. And he finds this, he had this letter. This is what gets me, John. He had this letter the whole time they were married. Maida was in love with another man, and she wrote a note. I cannot marry you. You know how much status and money mean to me. And he ended up killing himself. And then he just gives her the note and she tosses it up. I mean, this is perfect for your divorce. Show it to your parents. What's up with that? You know, I don't get that. You have this perfect note. Or maybe it was just humiliating to him and he just couldn't show people because she just married him for what he could give her. She didn't love him.
Yeah, I guess he is the least well-drawn of the three characters. I think he's so nice. You're right. He's so accommodating and even, like I said, protecting this woman who is so awful and is there for the audience to enjoy hating for 90 minutes. And there, on the other side, you have Carol Lombard, who is so beautiful and kind, a widow with a little girl. And, you know, it's not a fair fight. And it's the juice of this particular soap opera is we cannot stand for 1 minute how much longer Kay Francis can get away with fooling everybody except the two leads. And I do think Lombard is probably her best dramatic performance.
Oh, she was wonderful in this. I thought she was so good in this. And the two women were great in this.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
And what was up with that doctor? I think he must have been in love with Maida. But, you know, how did the parents not know? And she did get found out. And I love that part. That's wonderful. And Maida, you know, but finally after, you know, even when he was dying and they bring her in, Carol Lombard in to lie, they say, the father says, I'm sorry, it has to be this way. I mean, your son is dying. He hates his wife. Wouldn't you side with your son? Shame on you.
Yeah.
So.
Well, this is a good movie about what happens when, you know, people are standing in the way of true love, because we don't doubt for a second that Cary Grant and Carol Lombard are meant for each other and will be ecstatically happy. And here is this person who this evil person
manipulates. Yeah.
And again, it's money. How often we've talked about money being a part of messing up these sort of supposedly idyllic relationships where there's an ulterior motive that has to do with money. And this woman preventing this beautiful love. Now, true, it's interesting because, you know, divorce wasn't a subject that, you know, there weren't that many pro-divorce movies made in the golden age. And here, of course, the audience is all rooting for divorce because
Maida is horrible.
Yeah.
And her friend Suzanne, who was wonderful. I can't think of her name.
Well, it's Helen Vinson.
Oh, she was so great in this movie.
Yeah.
Such a creep. I loved it.
Yeah.
So
yeah, well, it's good because it sets up the good guys and the bad guys in very clear terms. And, you know, in a soap of this type, it's very satisfying. And I really, really, it's not a great movie, but it's a very satisfying movie.
Yes.
And it's still, when you have just a basic soap opera script, if you have really good people doing it, it gives it a complexity that I don't think is there on the page necessarily. But, you know, the depth in Carol Lombard's eyes, it speaks volumes, you know.
Yeah. And her sister getting all mad at her, too. Geez, just because she had a rotten thing. And then all of a sudden she meets the plumber and has a change of heart, who lives in Jersey with his sister. This is a really good movie to watch. Carol Lombard and Kay are fab. Helen Benson is too. Carrie is Carrie. You know, he's just kind of, you know, the love object, but it's not his film. It's Kay's and it's Carol's. And it's a really good film. And this shows, you know, that everybody can love your wife and she's a big fat liar. And if she ever, if you ever get a hold of a note like that, you know, show it to your parents and say, what is wrong with you? You should be supporting me, and get rid of the dame. So, well, she,
like Bette Davis in The Letter, too, that kind of, to outsiders, she's the picture of respectability. She's wonderful. The great lady of the town in this case and all that. And she's great at cocktail parties and all, but she's not a good person. She's a conniver through and through.
She's a schemer. Somebody said she was a scheming Mimi. I love that. She was terrible. But it is a good watch, and it's something, you know, that love does conquer all we imagine. But, you know, Carrie's still in the hospital, and Maida has that door slammed in her face. Yay.
Yeah. Yep. That's pretty satisfying. That's a good, that's a very satisfying moment, though.
Very slow. I love how it just goes really slowly onto Maida's face. See ya. And I bet the doctor ends up marrying her. He always takes Maida's case. He's like so hot for Maida. It's like ridiculous. You know, just get lost, bud. Anyway, I hope you liked our choices for anti-Valentine's movies. And just know, you know, thank you, John, for coming on. I, you know, I have been married, been in relationships, and I've never been a Valentine's kind of gal. I'm like, get me flowers a couple days from now. Do this if you want to do that. And I just want to say, you're not alone. There's a lot of people that are alone. Watch one of these movies, you know, buy yourself candy if you like it, and just be glad, because there are vipers around every corner who might tell you they love you. And they just don't. It's not the end of the world. That's for sure. Right, John?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not good in real life. None of that's good in real life, but it sure is good at the movies. I'll tell you.
It sure is. And, you know, just take care of yourself and don't feel badly. And there are wonderful romance movies if you like it. But, you know, I just know too many people feel the pressure of not being involved in a relationship. So I, you know, you ain't alone. You're not. Okay. So thank you so much, John. We had to do my, there was just a little bit of a technical glitch, but we got through it. Yay. And you were a wonderful guest. I can't wait till you come on again, because you know everything about the movies, like his books. And I'm going to link you guys up to his website and all that stuff. And, of course, I want you to come on again, because we only got up to like 1937. And you go so far. you were the perfect choice for this. So thank you. Thank you so much, John. This is John DeLeo, everybody. And thank you, everybody, for listening. I really appreciate it. And thank you, John. Bye, everybody. Happy not Valentine's Day, or happy Valentine's Day for anyone, whatever you wish. Take care. Bye.